It's good to have your company. My name is Simon Smart, and you're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm honoured today to have as a guest the Fairfax journalist and author, the economics editor of the Sydney Morning Herald, Ross Gittins. Welcome, Ross.
G'day, Simon.
Good to have you in. Now, Ross, you've written for decades about economic matters, and especially in recent years, some of the themes that have come out of your writing I'd like to explore. The first of these is the concept of happiness. You've done some thinking around this. I know you appeared at the Happiness Conference in Sydney. But when you talk about being happy, you mean something more substantial than just feeling good all the time, right?
I certainly do, yes. And I think that's very important. I think if you have the very narrow definition of happiness, which is seeking pleasure and avoiding pain, there's no great virtue in that. That's really just hedonism, and I don't think that that puts any meaning in your life. It doesn't give you... It wouldn't leave you with thinking that you'd had a very satisfying life, which I think is really part of what you're trying to achieve with your life. But I also think that there are a lot of things that the people who study happiness and the positive psychologists have come up with, which have a very strong Christian resonance, probably also resonance with other religions, but certainly with Christianity. And one of the things that seems clear, if you writing a book about happiness and you're giving people tips on how to be happy, as I have done, one of the biggest tips is don't focus on your own happiness, focus on the happiness of other people. If you sit there taking your happiness temperature every 10 minutes, am I happy, am I happy, you won't be happy. But if you throw yourself into making other people happy, and often in reflection, you'll say, well, you know, I'm actually having a good time here.
Yeah, what do you think it is, that notion of helping other people? So it seems to be key to a full life or a flourishing life.
Well, I think it's because one of the most important elements of happiness is our relationships with our partner, with our children, with our parents, with our family, but also with the people we work with and the people in the neighbourhood and so on. That all this deeper study of what makes people happy puts an enormous emphasis on the quality of relationships. And when psychologists try to explain why people get a lot of satisfaction, most people get a fair bit of satisfaction out of their work. Part of the explanation is work brings you into contact with other people, with customers, with colleagues. We are a social animal, and we do get a lot of our satisfaction out of being with other people and working with other people.
Yeah, and you mentioned the psychologists, people like Martin Seligman, the positive psychology guy, and he talks about well-being, doesn't he? And some of those things that he thinks contributes to a life of well-being are things like positive emotion, engagement with what you're doing, finding meaning you've got a sense of something bigger than yourself.
Yes.
That's a key one, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Meaning comes from identifying with something bigger than yourself. And that probably is a big part of the explanation of why the empirical research is quite clear that people with strong religious belief tend to be happier than other people.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity.
A moment's reflection will tell us that there are plenty of things that can't be measured in dollar terms that are nonetheless immensely valuable. And I know you're a proponent of this well-being index. Now, tell us about that. It's designed to fill the gap, isn't it, between an overemphasis on, say, GDP as a measure of all things.
Yes, it is. It is trying to fill a gap. It's saying, look, we haven't had a decent measure, a broader measure of progress, if you like, And so we focused on this thing that comes out once a quarter that economists take enormously seriously, politicians take enormously seriously, business people take enormously seriously, whether it's up, whether it's down, can only be up by a couple of, by less than a percent sometimes. What that measures is our income and whether our income is growing or declining. Now, that's important, but it's not anything like the totality of progress or well-being or anything you want to think about that's broader than just income, wealth. Now, every economist would agree with that. And so it's kind of by default that so much faith and emphasis is placed on this. And so the Fairfax decided that we would try and get some economists to develop something that was broader than that and that took account of other factors. One of the factors that it takes account of is how the wealth is distributed, not just is Australia's has Australia's income increased in the past 3 months, but what's happened to the distribution of that income around the economy. The state of the environment, you know, are we getting richer in the short term by sort of plundering the natural world and will that come back to bite our children? That we take account of that. We take account of the fact that a lot of effort is put into educating people. That education has very real material benefits. A more highly educated workforce will be able to earn higher incomes, have a more valuable services that they can sell to people in other countries or sell to each other. And health is another obvious thing. I mean, I'm not saying that our measure of well-being is perfect by any means. We're limited by the fact that a lot of the things that a moment's reflection will tell you are very important turn out to be not well measured. I mean, when you think about it, the Bureau of Statistics, which is there to sort of measure all the things that are important, an enormous proportion of their resources goes into measuring GDP. And that's not really a criticism of them. It's a criticism of the demands that the community has made on them.
So this is an attempt, isn't it? This is an attempt to address the deficit there.
And as we get better at measuring non-monetary dimensions of well-being, we would hope to include that in this measure.
The Centre for Public Christianity, Beyond Religion.
Is it true that money doesn't make us happy?
It's not true that money doesn't make you happy. Money does make you happy, but it only makes you happy up to a point. That is, if you are really poor, it's nice to imagine people who are in dirt poverty that just, you know, not sure where their next meal's coming from, house is leaking, but they're still all having a lovely, happy childhood. When you don't have your belly full and when you don't have a decent housing and decent clothing and so on, you're not particularly happy. So up to a certain point, a point that the great majority of people in a rich country like Australia or America have passed long ago, having more money does make you happier, as measured by what people say about the satisfaction from with their lives that they've lived. But what you find is that after you reach past that point, getting more money becomes less and less powerful. With every $10,000 that I add to your annual income, you get less and less increase in measured happiness.
It's a diminishing return.
Diminishing marginal returns. It comes straight out of an economic textbook.
I was going to say, I remember that from school and you're right, I'm sure.
After you get much past $100,000 a year, another $10,000 buys an surprisingly tiny amount of additional happiness. There's also a significant likelihood that the people who have higher incomes, quite high incomes, and have slightly higher feelings of well-being, it's likely that a lot of that comes out of status rather than actually what you can do with the money. It's the belief that they look back on their lives and say, well, I've done pretty well. That is to say, I'm beating a lot of those guys, so I'm reasonably satisfied with my life.
You've looked at the work of Dr. Michael Schluter from the Relationships Foundation in the UK. What do you think have been his big contributions to this discussion of a meaningful life? I know he talks about reimagining what he calls a relational capitalism.
To say relationships are really, really important to the lives of every person among us is pretty obvious. But he was the first person to say that and start drawing out the implications of that, which is to say that we make a lot of decisions, and governments make a lot of decisions about how they organise economies, which don't take account of the relational implications of that at all. And there is actually a trade-off between what would make the economy more efficient and what effect that might have on relationships. The classic example of that is the weekend. Sunday. And you don't have to have deeply religious reasons for believing that the weekend, people having at least one day when no one in the family works, it is enormously valuable to the development of relationships. When everybody can get together, when you can, mother and father can be there, the kids are there. The kids are never going to be at school on the weekend. So, but I can make an economic argument that says if only we could keep all our buildings and all our factories and all our machines and all our supermarkets trading 24/7, that would make far more use of all that capital. And it's very inefficient to have all that capital lying idle for one day a week. Now, that's the economic argument. That's the efficiency argument. And that's pretty much the only argument that we've had during the period where we have, one, liberalised shopping hours so that in most states, most shops can be open for extended periods over the weekend and during the week. And the second thing is getting rid of penalty payments, which have been portrayed as a terrible thing, but are really saying to employers, how much do you need this person to work on a public holiday when he could be with his family or she could be with her family? How much do you really need them to work on Sunday? If it's that important, you probably should be paying them extra, because it's actually imposing a cost on them, and that's a social cost of not being able to enjoy the society of their family and their friends. Now, the question about what that did to family life, what that did to relationships, never really got a hearing. It did in Britain, because Schluter was there making the point.
More Christian perspective on contemporary life, publicchristianity.org.
In our contemporary society, it's often really hard to break out of lifestyle choices that are relationally costly. So if you've got the big mortgage, the private school fees, the two cars, the overseas holidays, it's very hard to find yourself in that and then break out of it. Do you agree?
Well, yes, it is hard. I'd say two things. One is, the choice is not between being a complete slave to all the things you've bought on credit, including a house, and moving to Nimbin and being a hippie, right? There is something in the middle, yeah, in between. And you may not be able to sort of go and have a tree change, but you can slowly move a little bit in the desired direction. Reduce your debt. Stop buying things on your credit card if it's acting as a burden on you. Not live in a house that's got a huge mortgage that you're really quite struggling to keep up with. Moving house is not that hard. So I think that it's possible to slowly extract yourself from some of these obligations. And I think part of it is for people who you know, work night and day, don't see much of their kids, and tell themselves that, you know, I'm making this huge sacrifice for my kids. Your kid would much prefer to see you at weekends, really, than have you buying in the latest stuff.
Ross Giddens, great chatting to you about that. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.